harmful for U.S. allies, and they better do something about their foreign policy rather than following in U.S. footsteps. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, recently China's surrounding areas, especially the region of Southeast Asia, have attracted much attention with several major summits taking place. China and the U.S. are actively engaged in summit diplomacy, not only holding summit between the two sides' heads of state, but also holding bilateral dialogues with leaders of other countries, respectively, to promote their own international agendas and foreign policies. The Joe Biden administration has continued to promote regional strategy and some measures that aim to contain China in some specific areas, including technology decoupling and reshape of regional supply chains. But as China becomes more powerful, Washington has to take into consideration the security risks of competing with China and work to intensify a strategic competition with China while avoiding a military clash with China. The Biden administration was eager to meet with the Chinese head of state to avoid misjudgment and conflict and resume cooperation in areas like military exchanges, climate change, and drug control. This is because of internal and external pressures like the midterm elections, severe inflation, and several countermeasures China has put in place since Pelosi's reckless visit to Taiwan. During the summit, both sides elaborated on their own policy stances on major concerns, bilateral relations, and significant global challenges. They also reached a number of important consensus which point a clear direction to development of ties. Washington's desire to stabilize relations does not mean that it has changed its policy towards China. The Biden administration still emphasizes competition with China. Compared with the Trump administration, it pays more attention to the role of allies. The Biden administration has stepped up its diplomatic efforts with Asia-Pacific nations and seeks to isolate China by strengthening cooperation with its allies, which, however, prompted the regional countries to face the dilemma of taking sides between two major powers. However, most U.S. allies are very resistant to take sides. For example, Prime Minister of Singapore Lee Hsien Loong indicated that ASEAN member states do not want to choose sides. Canberra has also sought to mend ties with China. In addition, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz took a business delegation on his trip to Beijing recently and reached a series of cooperation agreements. The fundamental reason that this situation occurs is the contrast of strengths and differences in interest. First, it is foolish to choose sides between two rival powers. China and the U.S. are two countries with the strongest comprehensive strength and international influence in the world. The state of China-U.S. relations not only affects the cooperation and competition between the two countries, but also has a huge impact on the global situation. For other countries, it is not in their fundamental interest to get involved in confrontation between China and the U.S. or to choose sides between the two. Second, decoupling with China is not in the interest of U.S. allies and partners. China and the U.S. are the two largest economies in the world. China-U.S. relations deeply affect the world economy. In the eyes of the vast majority of countries, a decoupling of economics or technology is not conducive to their own economic development. Third, there are cognitive differences between the U.S. and its allies and partners. Most Asia-Pacific countries and some of the U.S. allies and partners have a high degree of economic dependence on China's economy, and they have different perceptions of their strategic relationships with China. The U.S. regards itself as the global hegemon and the designer and defender of the West-led international order. It has a strong hegemonic anxiety with China's rapid development. Nonetheless, U.S. allies and partners in the West, or non-Western allies, which share Western values and political ideology, have a certain degree of anxiety about China, while most other allies and partners have no obvious strategic anxiety about China and hope to benefit from China's development. In addition, China actively conducts diplomatic work, expounds China's position and policies in a timely and comprehensive manner, and provides wisdom and solutions to promote peace and development at the regional and global levels. This has made many U.S. allies and partners improve their attitude toward China. There are indications that most U.S. allies and partners do not want to choose sides between China and the U.S., and they're not to and cannot fully follow the U.S. in restricting China. This not only reflects the reality that China's strength and influence have increased significantly, but also reflects the decline of U.S. on its allies and partners, and that the political and economic coercion and value-guided methods cannot achieve the goals of the U.S. If the U.S. does not change its zero-sum thinking and understanding of China, it will be difficult to completely change its China policy and its expectations for allies and partners. However, this is not in line with the will of all countries to expect world peace and common development.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When it comes to Peru, the country is unraveling quickly. Just last week, Peru's president, Pedro Castillo, was removed from office. His charge, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress and install a government of exception. This occurred just before he was due to face an impeachment vote. Then came his arrest, charged with allegedly breaching constitutional order. But these accusations were not enough. He was also accused of an attempted coup. Enter Castillo's vice president, Dina Boluarte. She also accused the president of a coup attempt. And just a few short hours later, she was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. Boluarte called for a political truce and the installation of a national unity government. No surprise that the coup set up mass protests all across Peru. This is while the unelected government ordered a violent crackdown, with police to have killed numerous protesters. Yet things have moved rather too quickly, leading one to conclude that there may be foreign hands at play, in this instance, from the U.S. For example, just 2 days before a coup against its elected president Castillo, The ex-CIA agent and U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's defense minister. And there are reports that Peru's defense minister, who's a retired brigadier general, ordered the military to turn against Castillo. The U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's unelected leader, Dina Boluarte, and reiterated Washington's wholehearted support. Kenna, in another post, tweeted, "The U.S. categorically rejects any extra constitutional act by President Castillo to prevent Congress from fulfilling its mandate." This all showed that the U.S. government had staunchly supported Peru's unelected administration. In a statement, the U.S. State Department stated, "The U.S. commends Peru's institutions and authorities for safeguarding democratic stability. Troubled by violent demonstrations and reports of attacks on the press and private property, the U.S. recognizes Dina Boluarte as the country's president." When Castillo moved to dissolve Congress, he cited Article 134, and he made it clear that it was only going to be a temporary closure. He said new congressional elections would be held as soon as possible. Yet the U.S. ambassador to Peru failed to mention Article 134 of Peru's constitution, which states, "The President of the Republic is authorized to dissolve Congress if it has censured or denied its confidence to two councils of ministers. The dissolution decree contains the call for elections for a new Congress." The U.S. Ambassador Kenna ignored all of this. Instead, she declared, "The U.S. emphatically urges President Castillo to reverse his attempt to close Congress and allow the democratic institutions of Peru to function according to the Constitution." By this, the CIA veteran meant that Castillo should simply allow the anti-democratic Congress to launch a coup against him. The U.S. Embassy in Peru subsequently published an official statement echoing exactly what Kenna had said. This was Washington's green light for Peru's right-wing-dominated Congress to overthrow President Castillo and for the state security services to arrest him without trial. So it's no surprise there have been headlines that read, "The U.S. egged on the coup in Peru." The move by Pedro Castillo to dissolve Congress ahead of a third impeachment motion seems to be the result of a pressure campaign with support from the U.S. But why would the U.S. be interested in a coup in Peru? One motivation behind the U.S. could be in Peru's natural resources. Peru has a wealth of mineral resources like copper, iron, lead, and zinc. Gold and silver are also found extensively. On the other hand, the U.S. has been against a group of left-wing presidents who have taken over in Latin America in what's called the pink tide, with many not leaning so much towards the West's economic and financial system, like from the U.S. After all, they did not reap the rewards that a Western capital system offers, which has turned out to be just a mirage. Brazil's president Lula da Silva has even said that it wants to move away from the dollar and decrease the dependency as much as possible. The CIA has organized many coups against democratically elected left-wing leaders in Latin America, from Guatemala's president Jacobo Arbenz in 1954, to Chile's president Salvador Allende in 1973, not to mention the attempts to remove the former Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez.
Japan is allocating $320 billion in an effort to build up its military, a move that would be unthinkable under previous administrations. But now, under the Liberal Democratic Party led by Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, surveys say the budget has the favor of over 70% of voters. The military developments include extending the range of Japan's missiles, stockpiling of spare parts and other munitions, reinforcing logistics, developing cyber warfare capabilities, and cooperating more with U.S. and other like-minded countries. The extension of the range of Japanese missiles is only meant to be able to reach China, if the need were to ever arise, as there is no other reason to extend the range to around 1,000 kilometers. The reason why Japan feels the need to advance its missile technology is the escalation of tensions in the Indo-Pacific region. North Korea has, on multiple occasions, tested intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads, one of which landed a little too close for comfort to Japan. The China-Taiwan tensions are also cause for concern for Japan, as a potential military escalation could put Japan in danger as well. This is because of the large number of troops and massive amounts of supplies that the U.S. has stationed in Japan, which they would most likely take advantage of in case of an escalation with Taiwan. Here's what Prime Minister Kishida said with regards to the military build-up plan.
We can feel a rapid increase in the severity of the security environment around our country. In countries and the regions surrounding our country, a strengthening of nuclear and missile capabilities, a rapid military build-up, and attempts to unilaterally change the status quo through power are becoming more pronounced.
Kishida also emphasized on the issue of China as a challenge to its security. He said, China's current external stance and military trends are a challenge to our country's peace and security, the securing of global peace and stability, and the enhancement of international order based on the rule of law. To which Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin responded by saying, Japan disregards the facts, deviates from the common understandings between China and Japan, and its commitment to bilateral relations, and discredits China. Japan even believes that Russia is a threat to its security, albeit indirectly. Tokyo sees Russia's war in Ukraine as a dangerous precedent that might encourage China to carry out a similar operation in Taiwan and cause unimaginable disruption to world trade. By taking stances against North Korea, China, and Russia, Japan must look to the U.S. and South Korea as its allies. $320 billion. Once the budget is injected into Japan's military, it will bump up Japan's ranking among the top military spenders in the world from 8th place all the way up to 3rd place, just below the US and China, even higher than Russia during a time of war. And this amount of expenditure is going to hurt Japanese economy. Kishida's plans will double Japan's defense outlays to about 2% of the country's gross domestic product over the next 5 years. It would also mean that Japan's defense ministry will now have 10% of the country's entire annual public spending. In the document that outlines the plan for the military expenditures, what is not included is how the money will come about. It's unclear whether the government will have to raise money through tax increases or whether it will borrow the money. But if we look at the reason behind this unprecedented amount of spending on military by Japan, that is known for its pacifist constitution, we will realize that if not for the US's recent provocative actions, Japan would not deem its security threatened. North Korea's ICBM missile tests only came about as a result of US provocations, and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has mentioned this on multiple occasions. With regards to the issue of Taiwan, if not for the meddling of the U.S. in Taiwan's affairs and the breaking of the One China policy that the U.S. had previously agreed to, China would not have conducted the biggest military exercise in its history. If not for the constant eastward expansion of NATO, spearheaded by the U.S., the war in Ukraine would also not have happened, and Japan's concerns over Russia encouraging China to also attack Taiwan would never come to be. It's almost as if Japan's alliance with the U.S. is costing them more money than it's bringing in. And that is completely disregarding the security risks that this alliance has brought upon the land of the rising sun.
Iran has wrapped the European Union over anti-Tehran measures taken by the Council of the European Union. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian denounced, quote, certain political shows that have been put on display by the Council under the pretext of defending the issue of human rights. The European Council has imposed a slew of fresh sanctions against Iranian natural and legal entities. According to a statement issued by the EU foreign ministers, 20 individuals, along with one entity, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, have been sanctioned over alleged human rights abuses. The bloc has also slapped sanctions on four more people and as many entities blacklisted over Tehran's alleged drone supplies to Russia. The bloc's new sanctions include asset freezes and travel bans to the EU. The ministers condemned what they called the widespread use of force by the Iranian authorities against protesters. The European Union last month imposed sanctions on a number of Iranian institutions and individuals, including the 24-hour English-language press TV news channel, over alleged rights violations following the recent foreign-backed riots in the country.
In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, they support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the riot.
Foreign-backed riots have hit various Iranian provinces since 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini died at the hospital on September 16th, 3 days after she collapsed at a police station. An investigation has attributed Amini's death to a medical condition rather than alleged beatings by the police. The violent riots have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces while also allowing terrorist attacks across the country. In the last 2 months, the terrorists have set fire to public property and tortured several Basiji members and security forces to death. Western states have been hyper-aggressively pushing the regime change agenda in form of hybrid war, making a sheer mockery of international law. Authorities in the US and the EU have openly and brazenly instigated rioters in Iran through official and unofficial channels. Iran's intelligence ministry has said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest.
Online, the MEK organization that's funded by and supported by NATO, they've been teaching people how to make Molotov cocktails, how to use weapons, and they've been attacking police bases, military bases, and also we've had terrorist attacks alongside the Pakistani border, in the no man land in Pakistan, and also in northern Iraq from Iraqi Kurdistan.
Iran says its enemies have waged a hybrid war against the Islamic Republic to weaken national solidarity and hinder the country's progress. Officials say huge amounts of weapons have been shipped into the country by Western and regional intelligence services to carry out terrorist attacks and conduct extensive psychological operations in order to stoke dissatisfaction amongst the Iranian people and make them accuse the Iranian administration for the growing insecurity.
The United States is finalizing plans to send Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The plan needs the final approval of U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin and the U.S. President Joe Biden. It is not known how many of the batteries will be sent to Ukraine, but reports say supplies to Ukraine will be limited. But according to available data, a typical Patriot battery includes a radar set that detects and tracks targets, computers, and a power-generating equipment. It also includes an engagement control station and up to 8 launchers, each holding 4 radio-fire missiles. The systems are likely to be sent to the U.S. Army base in Grafenwöhr, Germany, where Ukrainian soldiers are likely to be trained and use the equipment. Ukraine has long been requesting the U.S. to send advanced long-range air defense system.
The message is simple. Give Patriots as soon as you can. Because this is the system that Ukraine needs to protect its civilian population and critical infrastructure. This is not an offensive weapon.
Russia has already warned that Patriot missile systems in Ukraine, if are deployed in the conflict, will be targeted. The former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, who is now deputy chair of the National Security Council, had earlier warned that such weapons and their crews would be legitimate targets if a NATO member were to deliver them.
Washington уже сделал себя стороной конфликта в практической плоскости. Принимая во внимание растущие объемы прямой американской военной помощи, включая присутствие военнослужащих США на земле, передача столь сложного вооружения, обращение с которым требует многомесячной подготовки, будет означать расширение вовлеченности кадровых американских военных в боевые действия со всеми вытекающими последствиями. Настоятельно советуем тем, кто в Вашингтоне принимает решение, наконец прислушаться, возможно, не к нам, но к самим себе, сделать правильные выводы из наших неоднократных предупреждений о том, что любые поставляемые на Украину оружейные системы, в том числе Patriot, с соответственно обслуживающим персоналом, были и остаются законными приоритетными целями для вооруженных сил России.
The U.S. and its Western partners have already resupplied Ukraine's air defense missiles and shoulder-fired Stinger missiles and other larger air defense systems. Patriot missile system is one of the most advanced U.S. systems against aircraft and missiles. Ukrainian officials say the delivery of Patriot missiles would be a game changer. But the efficiency of those weapons for Ukraine in the war against Russia is not clear. Each missile battery would require dozens of well-trained air defenders to operate. Even with an accelerated training program, could be sometime in early 2023 before a system is operational in Ukraine. Experts believe the Patriot has a more powerful radar that is better at discriminating targets, but it has its own limitations. Its efficiency would depend on how the weapon was delivered. The success rate of the Patriot has been repeatedly questioned. In 2018, Saudi Arabia's success in using Patriots against missiles fired in the Yemen war were questioned when evidence of systems failing emerged. The Patriot does not reportedly perform so well against small drones. It is not known whether the system's radar could pick up the small, low-flying drones or whether there were other issues. The U.S. has now committed more than $19.3 billion in weapons and other equipment to Ukraine since the war began in February of this year.
As we work with industry to accelerate production on both replenishment systems and direct procurements under the United Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, or USAI, we're using a number of tools to get the funding moving and the contracting happen quickly. These include using contracting mechanisms called things like undefinitized contracting actions, sometimes called UCAs. What that allows you to do deliberately is to get industry working on an initial contract before we definitize it. And you can put a UCA together within a week, and we're doing that. We also are making use of indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts, or IDIQ. If you have IDIQs, and we have many of them, what you can do is just add task orders to them very quickly to get equipment on contract.
It is widely believed that those U.S.-made weapons are fanning the flames of war in Europe. But there are concerns that those weapons are falling into the wrong hands.
We're seeing this incredible, historic flow of weapons coming into Ukraine. Do we have any sense as to where they're going?
We don't know. There is really no information as to where they're going at all.
You know, all this stuff goes to the border, and then kind of like something happens, it kind of like 30% maybe reaches its final destination.
Washington is reportedly looking into technological solutions to the problem of weapons diversion. Western weapons earmarked for Ukraine had reportedly surfaced in the hands of militant groups in the African Sahel.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. The heads of the three powers of the state, executive, legislative, judicial, expressed their sorrow and sympathized with the grieving family. Then certain elements murder other people who are innocent and have not committed any crime. How can you make false accusations and insult such a huge organization that serves the people over the probability that perhaps one or two people have made a mistake before any research or proof has been presented? There is no logic behind this. It is clearly the work of none other than the spy agencies and malicious foreign politicians. Now, what is the motive of these foreign governments? My perception is that they feel that the country is progressing towards achieving a comprehensive power, and they cannot tolerate this. They can feel this and see it.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They can see that many old problems are fortunately being solved. Although the country has many problems, some of which started years ago, but serious work is being done to solve these problems and untie these knots. They can see the movement towards progress which is accelerating in the country. This is a fact. In all areas, an accelerating movement can be seen and felt. They can see and feel this as well. They can see and feel this as well. They do not want this to happen. They can see that factories that had been almost shut down have started operating again. They can see knowledge-based companies working. They can see advanced production day by day. In some sectors, they can see things being done that can neutralize the effects of the sanctions, which is currently the enemy's only weapon. They can see these things. In order to stop this progress, they are making plans. They have plans for universities and plans for the streets.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini left Tehran for the holy city of Qom 3 weeks after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He stayed in Qom nearly for 10 months. During this period, people would come to visit the Imam from all over the country. However, the great leader of the Islamic Revolution had to return to Tehran due to heart problem. Today, we will continue the story. Stay tuned, please. As it was said before, Imam Khomeini had to go up the steps to the roof of his house in Qom as people would gather in the alley to visit him. The Imam used to do this several times every day. Thus, he would get tired and his heart would be under pressure. Moreover, Imam Khomeini would receive a number of officials every day. This magnitude of work soon caused him heart problem in early 1980. One day his wife, Ms. Saghafi, noticed the severe pain in the Imam's shoulder and left hand, so she soon informed Haj Ahmad of the event. The Imam's special physician, Dr. Baher, asked for checking up his heart by a heart specialist. Ms. Farideh Mustafavi, the Imam's daughter, relates the story. Dr. Baher came to visit the Imam. After checking him, he said that the Imam's heart should be checked up by a specialist. Then he immediately telephoned Tehran and a medical team was sent to Qom. When I went to the Imam's residence, I saw that Dr. Zargar, then Minister of Health, was there with a few people. Medical checkup was done and the physicians came to the conclusion that the Imam should be checked up for a few days. Therefore, the next day, the Imam was sent to Tehran in an ambulance and was hospitalized at Tehran's Heart Hospital. The day after, my mother came to Tehran and went to his father's house. Then he went to the Imam at the hospital. The news of Imam Khomeini's hospitalization spread across the country in a few minutes. Thus, a big crowd of people gathered in the streets around the hospital. The medical team asked the people to pray for the Imam's health and immediate healing. People gradually left the area as they had become sure of his health. But the enemies spread rumors on Imam Khomeini's demise or his suffering from an incurable disease. Meanwhile, in spite of the physician's recommendation on absolute resting, the Imam delivered a very short speech, which was televised and broadcast on TV. This short speech ended all rumors of enemies. Fortunately, Imam Khomeini gained his health with the efforts of doctors and the prayers of people and left the hospital. The medical team said that the Imam should reside near the Heart Hospital to be under surveillance. Imam Khomeini accepted the recommendation, although he liked to return to Qom. Therefore, a house was determined in Darabad neighborhood of Tehran, but due to people's frequent commutation, and the medical team's presence, there were disturbances for inhabitants of the place. Thus, another place was proposed for the Imam's residence. Haji Ahmad and the daughters of Imam Khomeini saw the house and accepted it as it was adjacent to a Husseiniye, which was a suitable place for public meetings. The Husseiniye was called Husseiniye Jamaran. A few days later, the household furniture was transferred to the new house. Husseiniye Jamaran was half-built and it was full of construction materials, but it was completed with the people's effort within 4 days. In mid-May 1980, people decorated the street to welcome the Imam. Imam Khomeini came at 7 p.m., while a big number of people had gathered there. After entering the house and looking at the rooms, the Imam said, "Now I am comfortable, as I was under pressure for 4 months." The new house was small, but the Imam liked it. At 8 o'clock, the Imam said that he was ready to meet the people around the house. Therefore, the first public meeting was held at Husseiniye Jamaran. A few days later, the VOA said that after a few months of searching, a place had been determined for Ayatollah Khomeini, which is immune against any air raid. The next examinations revealed that the Imam's residence was suitable in terms of security, as it was beside mountains and surrounded among tall trees. Although the Imam's wife would complain about the size of the rooms, the Imam told her, "This is a good house. Those who come here will know that this is your house."
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul. Thank you.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protest through Brussels on Friday was organized by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol, and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the Eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus, and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
people providing the nation with care, asking to be looked after by the authorities. Some of the tens of thousands of UK nurses who have walked off their jobs demanding better pay and conditions. Lakshmi has worked for the NHS for 22 years.
Shortages of nurses have led to less staff, and you can't care for people if you don't have a staff to care for. So it's person safety mainly, and if here comes, obviously people are leaving profession due to unfair pays, overworked, stressed, and shortage of staff.
Hailed as heroes during the pandemic, nurses up and down the country, Save Scotland, are staging two 12-hour strikes this week and next. Their representative body, the Royal College of Nursing, says they had no choice when the government rejected calls for talks on NHS pay. The RCN says nurses are 20% worse off in real terms today than they were in 2010 due to successive below-inflation pay rewards.
Things have gotten so bad that hospitals, one in four hospitals, are having to set up food banks for nurses and for other staff. This is unprecedented. But we're not just fighting for pay, we're fighting for the survival of the NHS.
One reason for that concern is the number of staff leaving the profession. 25,000 nursing staff have quit the NHS in the past year. The government says the demand for a 19% pay rise is not affordable. The unions argue the money is there. The nurses' strike is part of a wave of industrial action sweeping the UK this year, with the strikers demanding better pay and conditions as a worsening cost of living crisis pushes more and more people into dire straits.
The unions are warning that the strikes this month could be the beginning of a longer period of action if governments refuse formal pay negotiations or if future talks do not result in satisfactory outcomes. Saeed Purizep, London.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Dalal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects of life.
The Yemeni government says the illegal seizure of Yemeni oil is an act of war and a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, which will be met with force if continued. Yusuf Maori, Sana'a.
As they came together for a summit in Brussels, EU leaders were acutely aware that energy storage tanks will run dry in the coming months. There are still major divisions in the EU over a gas price cap and a proposal to buy energy from international suppliers as one single customer.
It is important that we do not outbid each other as member states, but that we use the market power to purchase gas.
It's thought a deal might be finalised on Monday. There are plenty of other divisions within the 27-nation EU. Austria is blocking Romania and Bulgaria from the border-free Schengen area. Meanwhile, funding for Hungary is being withheld over rule of law issues.
Russia is blackmailing us every day. But if we start to blackmail each other, this is not good. And this is absolutely not good for European Union.
A dark shadow of corruption is hanging over the EU. It emerged last Friday that Qatar has been bribing politicians and officials.
This scandal is a very serious...